Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for joining us today. We've got a very, very cool one. Someone that was referred to us by Admiral Allen when he was on our show last. And I think we are all going to take something away from this one. Who I've got on the line today, Rear Admiral Kerry Thomas, born and raised in Colorado, grew up in the hills of the Appalachian Mountains on the wrong side of the line. I think she grew up in Virginia versus West Virginia, where I'm from, but that's okay. Coast Guard Academy graduate, class of 1984. Her first assignment was the Coast Guard Cutter Vigorous out of New London, and then went to the Coast Guard Academy as an admissions officer. Went back to sea from there as the operations officer on a 210 in Galveston, the Valiant. Then to a joint assignment in Key West at what has become Jayadef South. Then took command of the Coast Guard Cutter Manitou, which I think is going to be a part of her story today as she talks about some responding to some Cuban and Haitian migrations at the time she was in command. Went from there to headquarters at EPM-1. That's Advancements, Separations, and Assignments for Enlisted Personnel. Had to do another follow-up headquarters tour at the Office of Programs. Did a lot of budgeting there, the civil engineering accounts. And then went to Group Air Station Atlantic City. From there, as the executive assistant to Admiral Allen at Atlantic Area, and that's where she was on 9/11. Went from there to the Navy War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Was then a plank owner at Sector Miami as the sector response. That was during probably one of the most active hurricane seasons in memory with Katrina, Rita, Wilma. Went back to land area after that as the resource director. Was involved in a few special projects to include a study on the culture and climate of the Coast Guard Academy and a reorganization team that yielded ForceCom, or what we now know as ForceCom. Went from there, where a lot of people probably recognize her name as the commanding officer of Cape May. So anybody that went to recruit training definitely had a few years under her. Then was selected for flag. Went to headquarters as the assistant commandant for response policy. Created the emergency management postgraduate program for enlistment members. And also negotiated some of our initial agreements for Arctic response to search and rescue and oil spills with all the Arctic nations. Went from there to the what she calls the arduous assignment. It's the 14th District Commander living at Diamond Head Light out in Hawaii. And then back to headquarters as the Assistant Commandant for Human Resources, or CG1. They do policy for personnel and was involved in a lot of diversity and inclusion. She retired in 2016 after 32 years of active service, went on to become the National Executive Director of the Navy League of the United States, and now is the Chief Executive Officer of Coast Guard Mutual Assistance and has been there for 2 years. And we are lucky to have her on the show to not only share a sea story, but also talk about her work and the work of the people at Mutual Assistance. So with that, Admiral Thomas, we thank you for being on.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks for reminding me how old I actually am through all that big, long introduction.
No, I mean, I think it's important to put out there all the programs that you went through. It definitely shows a lot of diversity of career, I think, to get to that rear admiral level. So what an amazing career that you had.
Yeah, I loved my career. You know, it's funny, I was interviewed, I was stationed in Manasquan Inlet as a cadet. And the Asbury Park Press came over to me and they did this little article about me. And I said, well, I don't think I'm going to stay in the Coast Guard after my commitment is up, which was 5 years, because I don't think you can be both a woman and a mother and a wife all in the Coast Guard at the same time. So I'll do my 5 years and get out. I got my education. I got my family. And, that's what I wanted to do. And then I forgot to get out. So.
And it only took 32 years or so to realize it, huh?
Yeah, there you go.
That's awesome. Well, Admiral, I'll ask you what we ask every guest to kick off the show. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
You know, I would say probably being the captain of the Manitou during the Cuban migration in 1994. We had just gotten back from the shipyards. We had been in New Orleans for about 8 weeks. Putting the 110s through a big availability. And when you're home ported in Miami, you're run pretty hard there. And so I inherited the ship that was about 10 years old, and it had had a lot of great operational contributions, but hadn't been maintained too well. So we spent a lot of time in that shipyard, really taking it down to parade rest and bringing it back up. We had been back home for maybe a week or so, and the call came, you gotta go. And so you gather up your crew again and you head south, and over the course of the next 8 weeks there was a sea of humanity at a couple of points everywhere that you looked. And people in these rafts, people in these makeshift cars, just trying to get to a better life. And One of the things that was so scary about it was that the way the 110s are configured, many of your listeners know this, you're either at 10 knots or you're at zero, and which during the day is okay because you got somebody that's up there actively looking at it. But at night, when you look in every direction and there are people there, the last thing you don't want to do is hurt somebody in the course of that. So. Night times were pretty scary for us. We would typically run till about 11 at night, and then we'd actually, when the weather was good enough, shut the engines off and just drift for a few hours to allow for people to get some sleep, and then we'd get started about 4 or 5 again in the morning. Having to drive by people because we assessed their raft that they were in was pretty good, but we'd see somebody ahead of us, not in the greatest of kinds of rafts. Pretty, pretty hard actually driving by somebody who was at sea.
Where were you guys at? Like specifically, how far off the coast were you when you were seeing these multiple rafts?
So it was, it's 90 miles between Key West and Cuba. So we were anywhere between, just right off the 12 miles of Cuba up to, probably halfway between the two. And initially, we just picked them up until we were full. And then, along came a 210 or 270 and we'd hand them over to them within probably about a couple, 3 weeks, maybe a month. Some Navy ships would show up. And so then we'd pull up alongside the Navy ship and drop them off to the Navy ship, tie it up, in the belly of an amphib was challenging, to say the least. And then
you had to pull into the amphib, or it was like
not into the amphib. What they did was they lowered the tailgate down, and so then you just tie up to the tailgate.
Oh wow! Yeah.
Yeah. So one of my fellow captains down there at the time poked a hole in his ship. I was grateful that we didn't have that challenge, but you know, for
just
sure that was
solid ship handling on the Manitou's part, right?
Well, not always. You know, I was alongside one of the Navy ships one night, and the wind was blowing pretty good that night, and I could not get away because it was blowing down on me, and we were trying like hell to get away from the thing. And so I see this Master Chief on deck, and he's kind of smiling, and so I just kind of yelled over to him. I'm like, Master Chief, I'm out of ideas. Help me out here. And so he suggested back and down on line three, which you don't normally do when you're getting away from the pier. Usually you come ahead on line two a little bit, get your butt out, and then you, pull away. And he goes, I think you'll be fine if you back down on three, get your head away from the ship, and then move on from there. And it just took his extra set of eyes to really help me out. And so I don't know who that guy was, but, he was one of the many people who, really helped make it a really memorable time for us.
It's cool the things you remember, right? Just this random Master Chief standing on the back of the ship saying, back down on three. That's neat.
Yep. Yeah. It was really, I have many, many of those kinds of experiences, throughout my career.
So in, during this mass migration, this is your first command, right?
Yep.
And how old are you at the time?
28, maybe. I'm pretty young. Lieutenants, they think they know everything. In fact, they know very little.
Right. I always ask, like, on your first command, you're going down to take over this thing. And what's it feel like? What do you do differently now that you're the one in charge? You're the one responsible.
Well, so it's different. My husband is retired Coast Guard as well. And he had just had his command. He had been the captain of the Padre in Key West. And then we went up to Miami and I took over the Manitou. But we were very different kinds of captains. And, he's your very informal. People called him Skipper. You know, I'd had two MECs under my belt already. And, was a little bit different type of a captain. We were just a little more formal in how we processed things and how we interacted with one another. I don't think there's one right or wrong way. In fact, they're just different. And, I was also a mom at the time. My daughter was maybe four. So being away from her, not the first time, I'd gone to see back when she was 6 months old as well. Not the first time, but as your kids get older, their needs continue to grow and grow. And, I miss being with her, but, what a great assignment. And, I'm still in touch. One of the non-rates on my ship is now a commander. The ops officer on my ship, as well, he was a QM2 at the time, done extraordinarily well. I think Todd has probably 13 or 14 years sea time underneath his belt. He'll be in competition for, the Ancient Mariner one of these days, probably as a commander or maybe as a junior captain, had a lot of sea time. I had two great XOs, very, very different. I had a terrific EPO, and all of us, we just all worked together and really, really grateful for all the work that we did.
What was your command philosophy?
I believed in allowing people to talk about what it was that was interesting to them. It was back in the days of total quality management. You're probably not old enough to remember that. But the idea was, and it was long before social media, was that anybody could have a say in in kind of things. And that doesn't mean that you're not allowed to, that you don't have structures and you don't follow orders. That's not what I'm saying at all. But what I am saying is if you see something that's not working quite right, that you have the ability to speak up and do something about it. I had lived sort of through my career with three watchwords. They were commitment, courage, and character. And while I would love to say that I made that up myself. In fact, I found them on a box of Girl Scout cookies one year.
Awesome.
And I really sort of felt that people, you know, in this idea of making a commitment to make yourself better, make your unit better, having courage. And courage means a lot of things and a lot of different aspects. You know, as I got a little later in my career with all of the things about sexual harassment and sexual assault, I really sort of morphed that into having the courage to speak up or speak up on somebody else's behalf. And then to have character, you know, is the embodiment of the core values of honor, respect, and devotion to duty. And to be able to do the hard things, you know, even when no one is looking, is truly defines what your character is. And those three watchwords served me pretty well, you know, throughout my career.
Very cool, ma'am. I like how they adapted as you went forward and you were able to apply them to something else. That's awesome. Let's take it back to the mass migration down there. What's the craziest thing that you guys saw or responded to?
Well, I'll talk about an off-duty thing first. I got promoted to 04 when I was down there.
Is this a wedding down story? Because we got to be careful with wedding down stories. And I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
It is a wedding down story. And so I, you know, I, after, you know, I wake up one day and it's time to get promoted. I did have my college advisors with me. I think I had gone to the exchange there in Key West and picked them up at some point. And I was so happy with my crew that, you know, as we're wrapping up, most of the time you're ready to get home and you're putting on those liberty turns. And the crew says, hey, let's take the time to celebrate you getting promoted. And so we spent the night in Key West. We rented a schooner, one of those sunset cruise schooners. And, you know, went tooling by. I don't even think you're allowed to do this anymore, but, you know, went patrolling by in the schooner by the base there, and we shot water cannons at our own ship.
Awesome.
So that was
very good.
We had a really fun time that night. You know, during the case, during the time itself, one of my most memorable moments was a woman. She was in her 80s, probably. I got a little angry at her family because they took her on this journey, and I thought it was, you know, I understood why they did it, because they wanted to leave their country and search for life in our country, that, you know, to make things better. But, you know, both when I'd see little kids and I'd see older people, that they would put these people in jeopardy. But so she got up on deck. She wasn't able to get up the Jacob's ladder. And so instead she just stayed in the small boat. We put the hoist up to the rail and then helped her step over. My bosun mate, my first class bosun mate, was a big burly guy. And he gets over and she gives him the biggest hug that I ever remember seeing. And it was just one of those moments that you can never forget. Now, another challenge that I had down there was at the time when I first got down there, they still had a wet foot, dry foot policy. And that is that if you got picked up, you know, you got to be brought in if you were Cuban before they changed the policy to the wet foot, dry foot. And so I had a load of Cubans on deck, probably about 120 or so of them. And was sitting in Key West Harbor waiting
on a 110. You had 120 on a 110.
That was pretty normal actually during that.
Wow.
We would have some arguments between captains on how many you could actually put in, and that's a whole separate story. Because, you know, you had to be really careful about where you put them, because you needed to put them in a safe place so that if something were to happen and you needed to fight that main engine room fire, that you could get to them. It became sort of a competition on how many Cubans you could put on, which I didn't care for at all, because I didn't think it was safe.
Well, especially on a 110, I feel like if you go to right from right to left, like you can feel the boat lean a little bit.
Yeah.
That's wow.
And you could actually see people whose center of gravity shifted,
right,
as they would get a little overloaded. So I'm sitting with a group on deck in Key West Harbor, and I get told by the group that I got to turn around and go back out to sea because the president had made the decision that the Cubans were all going to get repatriated and screened in Gitmo, and then they might be able to stay in the U.S. and get brought there, or they might have to go back to Cuba.
Now, when that decision was made, ma'am, did you did they already have? I mean, I'm assuming. So when you guys picked them up, the intent was you're going to bring them to the mainland, and then they would just be, you know, kind of
give it to their families. Yeah,
right. Welcomed into the United States. Right. So
yeah.
Now,
yep.
Now this comes down, and I would think with, you know, any migrants on deck, now you're generating some force protection concerns too, right? Just
yeah,
because I mean yeah, did you tell them what was going on, or was it more like kept it a secret?
So we had a couple of Marines with us, actually, for force protection purposes.
Okay.
That were given to all the ships for this exact reason. But the expectation was, and they all knew when they left, that the U.S. policy was to, you know, if they got picked up at sea, that they'd be brought in. And throughout the course of, you know, my career, I had been you know, when families would come, I would sign a little piece of paper that would have my name on it, La Capitana. I'd sign my name and I'd give it to them as a little memento for them. I wasn't doing that during the migration because we were just too busy. But and so I knew sitting in Key West Harbor that if I turned around and went back to sea, I was going to have a problem. So I did my best. I probably may have said some four-letter words over the radio and basically asked for a butler. And it was truly just an implementation of the policy challenge, because I understand I've been a policymaker. I understand the implementation is important and you've got to get to it. It's just the transition of it wasn't either thought about or whatever. And through some course of cajoling and relationships that I had with the people at the group, was able to get those migrants off the deck into Key West. And then if you were still out of sight of land, that then you took them off to get them to a Navy ship or to a Coast Guard ship to send them to Gitmo for screening. And then if you were within sight of land, then you could just go ahead and bring them in. And that was the end. That was the change of the policy at that point.
Yeah, fair enough. It's kind of like a happy middle almost, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's, yeah. Man, unreal. What a time to be down there, I would think.
Yeah, it was a life-changing moment for me. It's kind of funny because my daughter was, you know, when you're 4 years old, you don't understand why your mom is gone. And so they were watching TV and they were looking for, you know, Cubans on TV. And they said, let's see if we see mommy's boat. And, you know, she got pretty upset, you know, that I was gone and that the Cubans had taken her mommy away. You know, put in a 4-year old mind, you don't really understand kind of what's going on. But sure. Yeah.
And why do you say it was life changing? What do you think? What changed from that point forward?
Well, I think it gave me a new appreciation for being an American.
Right.
And what I found, even when I was traveling around the Pacific as the district commander, was that people are hungry for United States leadership, or when I was negotiating those agreements. You know, people want to know what the United States is and what we do and how we do things. So understanding, you know, what that is, how loud the voice of being an American is and when to use it and when not to use it. Had the privilege to travel to Papua New Guinea when I was the 14th district commander, which is down by Australia. And I came at the request of the ambassador because he was having a women's empowerment event at the in the country there. And so he brought in some 500 women from all these different villages to teach them, you know, about, you know, that they can have a voice too. I remember meeting with the first lady and she was telling me that in her own family, that they would make decisions about how to educate girls differently than they would educate boys. When I would meet with the search and rescue officials, I'd ask them, how do you make decisions on when you're going to go? Because they only had 10 patrol boats in their whole Navy, and they don't have enough resources. The Australians have given them what they have. And they get, you know, some help from other countries. But how do you make decisions? And they said, well, if there's 10 or more men, we're going to go get them. And it just kind of, you know, took my breath away where, you know, what do you mean? You're making decisions on going to save somebody based on their gender? And it just all, again, you know, made me appreciate what being an American is about.
Wow. Yeah, that, I mean, I could only imagine, like, how that impacts you. Hearing that, that's unbelievable. Let's go way, way back. So you said when you were, you know, at the academy or they had interviewed you as a cadet that you said 5 years and out, right? What was your introduction to the Coast Guard? What was the thing that, you know, aside from, you know, the family and the paycheck, what happened that made you a lifer?
Well, I ended up in the Coast Guard. My dad took me to the Outer Banks for the very first time when I was about 10 or 11. And I completely fell in love with the ocean, every single thing about the ocean. Like I became this, I wanted to be a marine zoologist. I wanted to be Jacques Cousteau. And there is only one Jacques Cousteau, you know, but I was pretty good in math and science in school. And, you know, so my teachers and my family encouraged me to think about, you know, some kind of engineering that dealt with the ocean. So I make a list of what schools are there that have these kind of degrees. I'm also looking for a way to pay for college because while my father worked very, very hard, he really didn't have the means to be able to put me through college. And so I knew I needed to get some kind of scholarship if I was going to figure out a way to pay for it. And had gone off to the Naval Academy. Of course, I'm living in Maryland at this time. I had a guy a couple of years ahead of me at the in high school who had gone off to Annapolis. So I went down his plebe year for a dance and, you know, looking around down there. He's like, oh, Carrie, he goes, this is no place for women. He says, but I hear things are much better at the Coast Guard Academy. And so, you know, I checked it out all those years ago. And this is in the late 70s. Women had only been going to the service academies for a couple of years. But there were no restrictions on where women could serve, any ship or any airplane in the Coast Guard. They could go. It made some challenges in the late 80s when the Coast Guard deployed over to Iraq after the first Gulf War because the Coast Guard sent some ships over and the Navy says, oh, no, you're not sending ships with women. And the Commandant at the time said, oh, yes, we are. And I was really proud of the Coast Guard, you know, for doing that. So, you know, I found out about the Coast Guard Academy. I never visited. I got an appointment. Like I said, I thought I'd get my education, get a family, get out. I got my education, got a family, and forgot to get out. Now, I was a pretty crummy cadet my first couple of years. My mother wrote me a letter my second year there. And I guess I called home and said that I was quitting. My grades were terrible. I had a 1.32 my first midterms there. They also had a process of where peers would evaluate one another. And I was doing very badly in that as well. I didn't know how to be a good team player at the time. And it took me a good first couple of years to kind of get my act together. And my mother wrote me this letter that I still have today. And it starts out something like, Dear Carrie, it's midnight and I'm so mad at you that I could spit. I don't know what your problem is. I don't know, you know, what you think you're going to do if you leave the academy because your grades are so terrible, you won't be able to get into any college. So you need to work a little harder and you need to just, buckle down and get through this year. And, you know, at the beginning of my third year there is when they start to put you in leadership positions. And I had been in a lot of leadership positions, you know, throughout high school. I'd been the vice president of the first chair of that. And, you know, I just had never really learned how to be a team player. And that summer, suddenly the light bulb went on and I'm like, oh, now I understand. and then went a complete turnaround within the next couple of years. And, you know, that sort of solidified it. And I had a couple of really great chiefs in first class on my first unit. It wasn't easy. Like the first day aboard my first ship, you know, there had been a woman who had been stationed aboard before me who didn't have the best service or reputation. And one of the chiefs says to me, okay, what chief are you going to sleep with? And, you know, so it took me probably about 6 months to get everybody to understand that I was not the same officer. And once that went through, then I had a great assignment. And, you know, eventually was the first lieutenant, became a pretty good ship handler. I was a horrible ship handler at first, crashed the pier more than once down in Guantanamo Bay. And then by the time I'm the ops officer, I could put 210 foot of ship in about 220 foot of pier space.
Nice.
So, but a lot of that foundation was due to, you know, some of those people that kind of took me by the ear and helped me in my earliest foundation.
What was your first case on the 210?
It was my first patrol. We're leaving the Thames River. And so we've been gone probably 10 minutes and I hear, "Man overboard, man overboard. This is not a drill."
Oh man.
Turns out that, we had a non-rate who didn't want to get underway.
I knew that's what you were going to say. Something told me that's what was going to come out of that. Yep. That's good.
Yep. That was my very first case.
So. I'm assuming he got recovered and carried on with the patrol.
He was left behind, and I don't remember what his disposition was, but we carried on with the patrol for
that's
sure.
That's good. That was good. Well, ma'am, so you mentioned some interaction with chiefs. I will say it's the 100-year anniversary, right, of chief petty officers in the Coast Guard. Could you speak any more about chiefs and maybe the officer relationship or your interaction with them? Just something to commemorate the 100 years of the chief.
Oh, sure. I will say is that, chiefs were foundation to who I am even today. A couple along the way, I mentioned that chief aboard my first ship, who was really instrumental. A lot of master chiefs. I had never really worked with master chiefs until I worked in the enlisted personnel, and I get exposed to raiding force master chiefs. And some really, really great ones during that assignment, in which I, you know, they would teach me about their different ratings. And, you know, it's where I started to learn about how advancements worked, how when you go out of special assignments and then coming back in, and some of the crazy things that it does to the advancement, the speed of the advancements at the time in those 2 years that I was there. We had a couple of policies, one called High Year Tenure, in which we had some third class in the service that had been in, for 20 years, and they were still third class. But the Coast Guard decided that they wanted to move people along a little bit. And so that's really when the first beginnings of High Year Tenure came about. We also implemented a policy called the Temporary Enlisted Retirement Authority. And so there were people who were able to get out at 15 years because it was in the middle of something called streamlining, in which we got rid of Governor's Island. We did a whole bunch of reorganizations, and we needed to reduce the size of the Coast Guard. And so we were letting people out early. We also had a centralized first-term reenlistment policy that allowed for people to change rates, which made some people mad because they didn't want to change rates, but did so in order to remain in the service. But those master chiefs were really, really important to help us make sure that when we were writing those policies that we did so in a really solid way, in a really way that made sense the best that it could. We were also in the combination of, because there had been five aviation rates and we went down to three, and some of the challenges associated with that. And so those rating force master chiefs working alongside the detailers, super, super helpful. Then later on in my career, when I'm an 05, there was a master chief down there at Sector Miami, and he had been around. The master chief had been in Vietnam and just was sort of a salt of the earth guy. And at some point I was pretty sad. I was pretty, I had had enough and I was ready to leave the Coast Guard. And he pulled me in his office and he's like, "God damn it, Commander." He goes, "This Coast Guard needs you. Now get your shit together."
Nice. Yep. Get back out there. Right. A little pep talk. Good.
That's exactly what I needed. And, so it was really important, having a master chief alongside me, when both good and difficult decisions as the 14th District Commander, super, super important as well. And so fundamentally just so important to, you know, the being able to have the Coast Guard that we have today.
Yeah, an insanely unique relationship, I think. I think that's why people like to hear about it, just because it's very nautical. You know, definitely unique to the sea services.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, ma'am, talk about your time as the CEO of Cape May, because I know that's where most people are going to recognize your name from, right? There's no doubt in my mind. You've impacted a lot of lives while you were there. So what, you know, what lesson or what crazy story do you have from your time as in command of Cape May?
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum. And that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Hey.
There's probably a lot. We don't have enough time.
Yeah, I know. No, I know. I think we may have been there at about the same time. I was well past boot camp, but I think it was about the same time frame.
Yeah, no, I loved it. And first thing I would say is that, guys got off the bus and they were a mess. And 8 weeks later, they were amazing. And that never got old. I wasn't in the trenches like the company commanders were. And so, but it, you know, never really felt like Groundhog Day to me. I am still in touch with a small number of people who went through boot camp when I was there. I ran into somebody one time who apparently I jacked him up for not stopping to greet me. It's not something I did too often because I was usually walking alongside the Master Chief, who would take care of that for me.
Right. Was Master Chief Smith there at the time? Was she?
No, she came in. She came in after I was there with a guy named Bruce Bradley.
Bruce Bradley. And, okay. All right.
And Master Chief Bradley and I had worked together. He had been the CO of a patrol boat when I was at Sector Miami. And so we worked very, very well together. And it was just a very great symbiotic relationship, between the two of us. And then the battalion commander, who was a guy named Jason Dykema, my first year. And then Jason Wong, Steve Dykema for my first year there. And then Jason Wong, my second year there. And so the three of us, you know, worked really hard together on a number of different issues. I think one of the more challenging ones I had was, this was early, early on in social media. And, in trying to develop some incentive training, which is necessary at Cape May, because people make mistakes and you got to teach them, how to not do what they're doing.
Define incentive training for us.
So, let's just say, you're supposed to, take it when you're in the head in the morning, get ready to get your uniform on, you're shaving your face and you don't do it quite well. Well, we had a book full of incentive trainings on how to properly shave. And
in all of the 60 seconds that you had to shave. And
that's right.
Just making sure everybody's got a clear picture of it. Yep.
And so all of these incentive trainings were vetted and approved, and they were done for the purposes so that boot camp could be as close to the same experience for every single recruit that went through there. Because back in the day, and I'm talking long, long time ago, it was more up to the company commander to decide what classes they went to, what trainings that they got, and how that they were going about. Some were softer, others were harder. Some would actually physically abuse them. All of those things were real. And so as part of standardization, in the same way in the boat forces world back in the day, a boat at, say, Station Fort Pierce might look different than a small boat at Station Manasquan Inlet. Well, you can't have that. You got to have standardization. So that process had been gone through. All of those incentive trainings had been vetted and approved. We encouraged people if they wanted to, if they had something new that they wanted to do, was to bring it up and let us try and include it into the policies.
I cannot imagine the ideas that you must have got, like when when you put that out there. That's pretty. I'm just thinking about what could have came out of that.
Well, unfortunately, one company commander, group of company commanders wanted to teach force protection, which is important. That you know, knowing how to protect yourself and others as a Coast Guardsman is important. But they came up with an incentive training that included actually putting tape around the hands of the recruits, taking their M1 rifles and actually pointing them at the recruits. And while the company commanders had the very best of intentions, this was right on the heels of Abu Ghraib. Right. And let's face it, we don't point our weapons at anyone unless we intend to use them.
Yep.
We had to go through an investigation. We had to take those company commanders out of training, which is never easy because then the recruits don't understand and the company commanders are pissed off about the whole thing. And then you have to go through the process of investigation and, deciding what to do when it's all done. Now, there were other times that we'd get reports that, oh, I got touched inappropriately or, oh, this happened, that happened. And so, again, the company commander would be removed from training. We'd do the investigation. More often than not, they'd get put right back into training right away with nothing to do. Sometimes they'd make mistakes and, they'd be pulled out of training for a couple weeks, but then they'd go back in. And it's not easy because all of the company commanders, and we had about 60 of them at the time, you know, anywhere from second class to chiefs and senior chiefs that were the section commanders, all well trained, all the epitome of what you want. But part of my job, part of the Master Chief job, is to just be that sort of throttle that helps sometimes. If the throttle gets pushed a little bit, you're like, okay, let's just take a little break and let's get back to it. So, you know. That was a challenge. I was particularly upset about, I don't even at this moment remember what it was that caused me to be so upset. It might have been that there was a picture of that Abu Ghraib kind of thing, by the way, and that's how it got to my attention. Somebody posted it on Facebook. And so I called them all in together. I'd been selected for flag by this time, and I had been pretty clear on what my expectations were. I knew that I had been. But I wondered out loud if I maybe hadn't been as clear that I should be. I called them all together and I took my shoulder boards my collar devices, for being an admiral. And I wrote a retirement letter and I put it on the table and I said, listen, if you do not feel that I have the ability to continue to lead this command, if you don't think that I have the ability to continue in the Coast Guard, I'm going to put this decision in your hands, because I'd like to think and that I've done what I can do in communicating my expectations to you, and we're still having a problem. And so I'm just going to leave it with you and you go all decide. And I walked out. So I left my collar devices. I left my retirement letter on the table and I put it in their hands.
That made me nervous. Just hearing that story, like that makes me nervous, you know, and I wasn't even there. So I could, I mean, what a moment.
And, I come back in the next morning and all that, that my collar devices were on my desk. And, I knew that was enough, to tell me of how they decided to deal with that situation. And they needed to do some of their own, you know, sort of self-policing, because I would tell you that peer leadership. So one of the courses I went to was up at Harvard, in which they teach you how to lead yourself, how to lead down, how to lead up. All of those are pretty easy, but leading each other in peer leadership is the hardest form of leadership. And I just knew that the key to that success was them helping each other and working together and just giving them the tools that they needed in order to help lead each other. And I'm very, very, very good shipmates with a very large handful of people that I worked with as company commanders. In fact, I just yesterday got a text from one of them who, I'm dealing with some family issues and my mom's a little ill at the moment. One of them texted me and just want to check in with the Admiral, seeing how you're doing. So those relationships last a very, very long time.
Also, the battalion commander, was it Master Chief Dykema or Commander Dykema?
It was Master Chief Dykema my first year, and then Senior Chief Wong took it my second year, and then we brought a guy in from a 378, a Master Chief MK, who had no training at all at Cape May, and not everybody agreed with me. Master Chief Lloyd Pierce, who had been a battalion commander one time, he and I had worked together on a patrol boat when he was an officer in charge and I was at Atlantic City, didn't agree with my decision to bring him in with no battalion experience whatsoever, but it was great having a fresh set of eyes, and he turned out to be an excellent company commander. So
was Master Chief DeCave still commanding 87s down there? Like one of the, I was just curious. Anybody that's been to Cape May knows Master Chief DeCave, I think, in a like a 20-year span or so.
For sure.
So I'll ask you one more, Admiral, before we get to the CGMA talk. When you were at group, or let's go to the sector. When you stood up the sector, how did it go? Because that was a whole new model for the way that things were done, right? And you were basically one of those first response chiefs. What do you think? I mean, how did it, was it smooth sailing? Was it not?
Well, I when I was a patrol boat CO, one time we boarded a sailboat off of Miami and we went aboard. Things didn't seem quite right, but I didn't know anything about MSOs. And so, I was walking down the hallway after I get back from this patrol and I just happened to run into one of the guys from the MSO and I said, "Hey, we just boarded this guy." He's like, "Are you kidding me? We've been trying to get aboard that thing for a year." And they were conducting illegal charters. And so the beauty of the sector was it brings together all of those authorities to be able to do things, the full suite of what is necessary. Now, it wasn't easy. But when you bring communities together, you find the best of both worlds. So I'll digress for a second back to Air Station, what was Group Air Station Atlantic City. So there was a couple of us black shoes that were there. It was me. I had a chief warrant officer, a bosun, and then a couple of guys on the watch floor, a couple of quartermasters and a couple of bosun mates.
What's a black shoe?
A black shoe is back to the times when aviators wore brown shoes and people on Cutterman wore black shoes.
Gotcha. All right.
Yeah. So so we're there, and the air station had run a couple of cases of some scallopers that had gone down off the Jersey Shore. And, the NTSB had been doing some investigations. So they were a little hypersensitive of when you have a fishing vessel start taking on water. So they'll put the airplane up right away and get a swimmer down there and get try and get the pumps running so they can get the flooding under control. So one of the cases happens and the pilots get back and they bring back the video. And this guy named Andy Fabo, who was the BM1 at the time, he calls me up and he's like, "You got to come see this video." He goes, "They're pumping out the Atlantic Ocean." And so I look at the video and it was a pretty bad weather out there. And it was probably 12 to 15 foot seas. And the swimmer is standing on deck like, he's not getting tossed around. He's not getting the bejesus beat out of him like he should be. And, both the bosun and I knew instantly that boat was full of water. And that was the reason that they weren't getting tossed around on deck at all. And so I got to get the group commander, this guy named Tom King, and he's a captain. So we pulled him in there. We're like, "You got to pull these people off. There's no way, no amount of pumps is going to be able to get a hold of this flooding." And it took some real sort of cajoling to to be able to get him to understand that he needed to shift courses in the course of that case. But did so, and we pulled those guys off, and they would not have survived had that boat sank. So now you fast forward to sectors, and the beauty that they bring is that you've got all these authorities. And so, you know, you've got an oil spill in which you've got authorities as the chief of inspections who can help liaison with the insurance people. You've got, career professional search and rescue people who can help say, okay, well, here's where the oil's going to go. And then you sort of put all these things together. We had a case of three guys who left at Christmas. They didn't speak any English at all. They were supposed to be back that night and didn't come back. And so their family calls in and, you know, we're pretty optimistic that we can get to it and we can't find them. And it's a pretty small op area, really, initially where you're searching. Although, of course, they didn't know where they went fishing. They didn't know where they left out of. But, you know, all the things in this art of search and rescue case that the detectives really put together. And one of my best controllers was a guy who had been a cop and had eventually come into the Coast Guard. He had been, I don't know what he was before he was an OS. So he ended up being an OS, when they created that rating, and was just super, super good. And his sort of detective skills were instrumental in putting all of this together. 3 days later, we were about ready to stop searching. And out of the corner of the eye, the C-130 that was flying for us on that first light search saw him. And, we diverted a commercial ship. No, I think it was a Navy ship, actually, that was passing by. And it got him aboard. They were tired. They were still in their boat. They were hungry. They just had an engine casualty, and they didn't have anything to eat. But, 120 miles later with the Straits of Florida and the currents that are there is how far they had drifted in those 3 days. Wow. So we got him on a helicopter, brought him back, and, there was not a dry eye in the house. We brought the press, and everybody was shedding tears when those gentlemen got brought back with their families. And, just really being able to bring all the various authorities together and the various communities and the skills that come with those communities is what was so beautiful about the creation of sectors, I think.
Very cool. Good. Excellent explanation. I love hearing stories like that too, where you hope was almost lost, right? And then all of a sudden, it plays out, and I think it gives you a lot of motivation to continue those searches, even when you're cold, wet, tired, hungry. Right. Just keep going. Yeah. Very, very cool, Admiral. Thank you for that. Let's get into your work now. So you work, you're the CEO of CGMA during, you've been there for 2 years. You've had some major events happen in those 2 years with a lot of associated need.
Can
you
sure.
just tell us about CGMA and maybe a couple of the more impactful things that you've been involved in with it?
You bet. So my first year was the year that we had both Florence and Michael come through. Two very different storms with two very different damages in the op areas. But both with needs, and so grateful to be able to help some number of Coasties down there alongside the Chiefs Association, alongside the Coast Guard Foundation. And what Coast Guard Mutual Assistance was able to do was get them typically about somewhere between $3,000 to $6,000 in their hands right away, and then let them start to get their lives settled after the storm has passed. And get things back to normal. And so, we pay in disasters, we pay for about $1,000 to replace the food in your refrigerator. We pay for the deductible in your personal property that you lose. We pay the deductible on your house, the damage that was associated to your house. We'll pay for the deductible for the vehicle damage, if you have vehicle damage. And so, it depends. Everybody's circumstances are different. And many, many of those they started out as loans. We let them, sit out there and let the insurance policy, take into effect. And then about 4 months later, then we'll go through a grant loan to grant conversion process, in which we try and, you know, convert as much of that to a grant as possible, because we want to get people's losses to zero to the extent that we can. And so happy to have been able to help with about $1 million in support for those two storms. And so then, you know, we think things are going to kind of get back to normal. And now along comes this little thing called the government shutdown.
Just a minor thing. No big deal.
And so I call up my buddies in headquarters. I'm like, how much does it pay to pay the Coast Guard workforce? Because, you know, not getting paid and financial assistance is straight up in our mission set. Mutual assistance has been around since 1924, and its mission in those almost 100 years is unchanged, and that is to help with the needs of it began as an organization called the League of Coast Guard Women, and it said that it's to administer to the general welfare of commissioned officers, warrant officers, enlisted men, civilian employees, and their families. So we've added women to the workforce. We've added reserves and retirees to the portfolio. We've also added auxiliarists to our client base here 100 years later. And so we're just so grateful to be able to help. So I asked my buddies, okay, what does it pay to, you know, what does it cost to pay the workforce? $180 billion. So I open up my bank account. I don't have $180 million in our bank account. I had about $500,000 in the checking account and about $23 million in stocks and bonds. And I'm like, okay, what are we going to do? And so, you know, it's a big problem set. I didn't know who was going to need help. I didn't know how much help that they were going to need. I didn't know how long that the government shutdown was going to happen. There were so, so many unknowns. And so we went about the process of just beginning to address what we could. The good thing was we had no debt. And so I was prepared to take out a line of credit against our portfolio. And so we started down the road of, at first, we're going to help our most junior workforce. Because when you pull out the pay tables and when you pull out the poverty tables and you take away BAH and you take away BAS, you'll find some similarities. At the E5 level and the GS7 level. And so that's when we started out with $550 in support if you were married and $350 if you were single. And while if you're a little more senior, that number doesn't seem quite right, when you actually put it in the context with the percentage of pay, it's a decent amount. So that was a good first start. And then as the time went on, we raised the levels then to 1,000, then to 2,000. And when we finished at 3,500 if you were married and 2,000 if you were single. Now, we were able to do that because, like I said, we were ready to take out this $15 million line of credit when we got a very large gift from USAA, the largest single philanthropic gift that they have ever given. They gave to a Coast Guard charity. And so that gave me a little bit more flexibility. So now I have access to $30 million, $15 million of our own, and this new $15 million that came in from USAA. And so that gave us a little bit of time, you know, and we felt a little bit better because what we saw was early on people didn't have needs. They had their local communities, their local chief's mess. They would go to a diaper bank or, restaurants were given free meals. But as the time went on, some landlords wouldn't, you know, put off their rents. You know, they had car payments from loan companies that wouldn't defer their car payments. They had child care that they needed to do. And so in the end, we did over 6,200 people with $8.4 million in 35 days. Compare that to 2016 when we did $4 million in assistance in the whole year.
Yeah, what a work day, huh? Wow. You know, and I can speak to that, Admiral. I mean, like I would say the government shutdown is probably the biggest leadership challenge that I've ever seen, right? It was actually what kind of spurred on this podcast itself was just to reinvigorate the workforce and just say, hey, there's all kinds of heroic stuff we can get into, right? Unfortunately, we didn't get paid, but I will say, you know, outside of even, you know, you were talking about that initial need, right? I think every time that CGMA gave a grant, gave a loan, it put people at ease, which right. was probably one of the most like impactful things that could have happened at that moment, was just to give people a little bit of breathing room so they weren't so stressed when they got home and didn't have the pantry full.
Yeah, it broke my heart, honestly, to see men and women in the Coast Guard not getting paid and still standing the watch and still saving lives and still calling up families and telling them that they couldn't search for their loved one anymore. It literally broke my heart. And I was just so grateful to be a part of, you know, what I really witnessed was sort of three lines of effort. You had advocacy work. So you had groups that were going up on the Hill. You had spouses that were going up on the Hill, people talking on CNN and Fox and all these kinds of things, not shy about, saying what was needed. And then you had, like in-kind support, you know, from gift cards to haircuts to barbecues and diapers and everything. I didn't decide if I would have taken assistance, if I was on active duty, but I sure would have gone to a diaper bank, I think, because those damn diapers are expensive.
For sure.
And that's one of my new favorite charities are these diaper banks. And then of course for mutual assistance to have been able to come in and provide assistance. We worked very closely with Mass Chief Vander Hayden's office. And there were some myths, right? That there were people that thought that taking a CGMA loan was going to affect their credit score, which it does not. They thought that it might affect, you know, that they wouldn't be able to use it later, that they might need it, or it might be taking it away from somebody else. And so, and then they were worried about turnaround on the payback and when was it going to have to be paid back right away. And so, you know, his office was instrumental. He sits on my board. And so I work for Master Chief and a number of other board members, in coming up with those policies of, okay, when are you going to start repaying and what else are you going to be able to do? The other aid societies as well sort of pitched in. And so there's aid societies for the Air Force, for the Navy, Marine Corps, and for the Air Force and for the Army. And, you know, I was in a cash flow problem. And so, if people needed help, and they live near a Navy base, I might send them to the local Navy base to, let's say their mother passed away and they needed the funds to get to their home so they could go to their mother's funeral. And I had a cash flow problem. I had to focus all of our cash on the government shutdown assistance. So we'd send them to the Navy base, and then the Navy gave them their money. And then the Navy held the bills until after the shutdown happened. And so they held our bills until then we played catch up later on. The Red Cross was an important part of that as well. And so people were able to get assistance via the Red Cross. We did that because we knew that people were in remote locations and we didn't want them to have to drive the 2 or 3 hours, or in some cases get an airplane or a small boat to go get your check. And so they had an electronic disbursement way to get things done via the Western Unions. Didn't work out perfectly, and so if people had to go to a couple three Western Unions, I apologize. If it were to happen again, we wouldn't do it the same way, because we do have electronic disbursement, and all you'd have to do is just sign up with Zelle and the money would show up in your account.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to apologize for. You know, a couple of hiccups in trying to get that much money out there. I mean, you know, it's all about meeting the need. Well, Admiral, where does the money come from? Like, who donates to you? Where do we, you know, for 100 years, this agency's provided this kind of relief. Where do the funds come from now? Obviously, you had the loan from USAA, but where do you normally get your operating funds?
So the majority of our funds come from other Coasties. Our motto is we look after our own, and it is instrumental in describing who we are and who we serve. And the majority of our donors are other Coast Guardsmen, people that served in the Coast Guard one time, people that are serving. We have non-rates to give $1 a month, and when you accumulate that over the course of your career, it's not an insignificant amount of money that they're giving back and being able to pave the way for future Coast Guardsmen. But one of the things I learned is that you need to diversify your revenue, right? And so I had known it academically, but
what,
I couldn't.
What great timing to bring that up, because, you know, with the government shutdown, I never really thought about diversifying the revenue of kind of almost an internal organization. Yeah, crazy.
That's right. And so what I realized when about $385,000 a month comes in from low Marie payments and from donations. And so this is money that I use to give back out to the field. To we have a very small staff. We're a staff of nine. We're smaller than a patrol boat crew. But I got to pay their salaries. I need to pay the rent for our offices. And so guess what? If the government's not getting paid, guess who else isn't getting paid during the government shutdown? Coast Guard Mutual Assistance. And so it just added to my cash flow problem. And so I knew I needed to diversify our revenue. So we do get some number of grants. We have a development director now who helps us with other foundations and ask for both corporate money as well as foundations that might want to help the Coast Guard in educations. We got a gift from a foundation that's a former Coast Guardsman, given to a number of different Coast Guard charities, and they wanted us to emphasize special needs. And so we have special needs grants and special needs loans. We've just changed our policy that allows for you to get a $3,000 grant every 5 years, because we know the needs of a 2-year-old are different than the needs of a 10-year-old or different than the needs of a 20-year-old. This donor asked for in their gift to us to emphasize special needs programs. And so, you know, being able to diversify our revenue has been important to, you know, sort of my strategic vision for the organization.
Definitely needed after what happened. Yeah, that's a very forward thinking, I would think. Well,
and so we also try and be as responsive as we can to other things. So there was some housing initiatives going on in the Coast Guard, people getting kicked out of their Coast Guard housing because of environmental issues. And when you're transferred mid-season, you're not entitled to your full DLA. So we came up with a DLA supplemental grant to help with that. We created a new policy for the breastfeed shipment. If women go TAD or their spouses go TAD and they're nursing and they want to, you know, express their milk and ship it home, we'll pay for that. People got stranded and abandoned during the Alaska ferry shutdown last year, and we helped with that. And today we're a little busy with coronavirus.
What'd you have to do with that? Did you have to hire like a plane to come out and get them, or what? When the Alaska ferry shut down.
What the Coast Guard did was they actually sent a plane to go get the people.
Okay.
So they got the people and they got their dogs and they took their weapons, I think. But they had to leave their cars.
Oh, okay.
And then they had to eventually go back. They'd have to fly back to this location and get their car and get it back. And so, you know, that's really sort of what our part of that was.
Yeah. So I always hear there's nothing but problems with the Alaska ferry system. It seems there's always, always some hiccup. You mentioned the coronavirus. So the new, you know, the latest crisis to hit the country, what are you guys doing for that?
So we're offering loans up to $6,000 if you have a loss of pay. You know, sometimes your spouse may lose their job because they've shut down their restaurant, and that was income that you were expecting. And so that is available. Also up to $6,000 for childcare. A number of single families, single parents, you know, suddenly they have to report to duty, and yet they're used to their kids getting up and going to school, and they've got that all worked out. Well, the school's now closed, and they've got to stand duty tonight. They've got now childcare, and so we're offering $6,000 for that. And we're helping with airline fees that may not have, some airlines didn't. You had change fees associated with that, and some, not all airlines did with that. We're giving grants for that. So again, we're trying to be as flexible as we can be during this. We don't know what the needs are going to be for a while, but we are standing by and ready to assist, help. One case that we heard of a first class whose grandparents, he pays for his grandparents' nursing home. Well, his grandparents' nursing home closed. And so what are you going to do with them? So you got to get them back into his house. And he's a single father. And his autistic child, because, again, they closed the school down, now he's got to get childcare for his autistic son. And so You know, we help them out with, it's just one case of what I expect is going to be many, many cases as the weeks and months of this coronavirus go in. You know, I just want people to know that Coast Guard Mutual Systems, like we have for almost 100 years, will be there for whatever your needs are. And we're so grateful to be able to help people, the Coast Guard, in their time of needs. And again, we're helping active duty, reservists, retirees, civilian employees, auxiliarists, public health service doctors and dentists, Navy chaplains who are wearing a Coast Guard uniform are in our client base as well. And then the widows. You know, we want to be able to help the widows as well.
Yeah, and for all the supervisors out there, I mean, I think, you know, anybody that's been around for a while has definitely seen CGMA come to meet the need of whatever it is, right? I think, like you said, it's flexible. So if there is a need, communicate that need. And what is the process, Admiral? Like, we'll go through two things. One, where can we find more about CGMA? What's the website?
Okay, our website is www.cgmahq.org. And we've got specific banners up there for coronavirus on our policies. And then if you need assistance, you just look on locations tab and it will tell you where your nearest representative is. If you happen to be in the middle of nowhere and you need help, you can just call us on our phone lines that are there and we're standing by available for that. Or you can go see the Red Cross. You know, all the aid societies as well as the Red Cross are all stitched together. The Red Cross has mobilized because all of the all of the services around the country for the Army shutting down some bases and things like that. These needs are real for men and women in uniform. And so the Red Cross is mobilizing there to be able to ramp up and help. And so if you happen to be somewhere where, you know, it's not convenient to get into a Coast Guard base or even a Navy base and you need help, you can go see your local Red Cross and they can help you with that.
Awesome. And CGMAHQ.org, right?
That's it.
Perfect. I'm going to link all over to it. I will ask, so I'm sure somebody out there listening right now has the means to give and to support your efforts. Where can they do that?
They can also do that on www.cgmahq.org. You can give securely via your credit card, or if you just like to do an old-fashioned check, we'll take those too. You want to put one of those in the mail. We are actually working on a way where you can send us your money electronically. And I also have a text number. Give me a second here while I come up with it, Phil, where you can text and it'll take you to our website.
Awesome.
Yeah, so we for sure love what we do and to be able to help with so many people. Okay, so if you text to the phone number 703-854-9450 and just say the word donate, it'll take you right to our webpage.
Can you give us that? You can give it one more time?
Yep, 703-854-9450. And just text the word donate and it'll take you straight to our webpage.
Awesome. And then I know a lot of guys do allotments, right? Or a lot of guys, gals, whoever do allotments through their pay. How does that work? When's the main fundraising campaign?
So coming up here in April, we were hoping that around the Coast Guard, there would be interesting things like bake sales and zombie apocalypse and 5Ks. Pretty sure that that's not going to happen this year,
right.
which is okay. But, you know, what we want people to do is to invest in the future of other Coast Guard members. And so they should be hearing from their local folks on how to upgrade or start an allotment. Oftentimes, and I was guilty of this on active duty, you start an allotment as a junior person and then you set it and forget it. And then here you are all these years later when your ability to give has increased and you forgot to upgrade it as you've upgraded your uniforms. And so, you know, hopefully all the new master chiefs, senior chiefs out there as you're going through the CCTI processes and teaching other people how to be chiefs, this is one way in which I know there's philanthropic charities that you guys talk about. And this is one thing that you could contemplate doing. And those forms are on our website as well.
Make sure you guys tell those junior officers all that too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Just had to get that out there.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, we need to. And it's been kind of funny because since I've gotten this job, I haven't been very shy about asking all the flag officers and about money, you know, and I can tell you that they have walked the walk, and I'm just really, really grateful, you know, that people understand what it is that we do. We're happy to be able to help, and you know, we're doing whatever it is that you know, people need in whatever crisis it may be that they can, or through focusing on your education, right? And so we have education grants of $500 a year. We're probably going to be up in that this year, a straight up grant for the books and fees. We have free tutoring. And so if you're stuck at home with your kids during this coronavirus and your kids aren't getting their math homework that they need quite right, tutor.com/military. You can sign up there, and there's a couple of links there, and get free tutoring, and then mutual assistance pays that bill as well.
Huge right now, I think, because everyone's stuck indoors, and I mean, what better way to better yourself, right, and better your contribution to the world than get some education?
Yep. We're also launching a financial resilience program. And so on the heels of the shutdown, we knew that people needed to assess what was their finance, were they financially ready? So we've worked with the Coast Guard to come up with a sort of a scorecard, and you go see a financial manager that the Coast Guard has, and they look at your debt to income ratio. They look at your credit score. They look at how much money you have saved for retirement and how much money you have saved for emergencies. You get a score. And then the plan is that you come back 6 or 12 months later and you've improved by a certain amount. You're going to get a grant from CGMA saying really good job for a job very well done for, you know, working on your financial future.
Very cool. What an awesome incentive program to reiterate those behaviors. Admiral, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you so much for your service to the country and for your continued service with CGMA. You know, I can't tell you how much I appreciate it myself, and I know that everybody else does as well. So, again, really thank you for being on.
You bet. It's been my privilege. And, thank you for what you do. I think this podcast is a really interesting way to, you know, let people tell some sea stories, but also get some great information out. So really, really happy to be with you today.
Well, thanks again, Admiral. And CGMAHQ.org. Head out there now. Support those that you work with and for, and make sure if you can donate, please do. Thanks, Admiral.
Okay, you bet.
Semper Paratus.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.